Hi, Janet.
Hi, Anand.
How are you today?
I am very well. Thank you. How about you?
I'm good. It's nice to see you today and it's nice to have you here. So today my guest is Janet Song. She's the R. David Thomas Professor of Business Administration and a Professor of Operations Management at the Fuqua School of Business of Duke University. She studies supply chain management and operations strategy, including topics such as supply chain inventory optimization and resilience strategies, assemble-to-order systems and supply chain flexibility, dynamic pricing and inventory control, data-driven operational decision-making, supply chain digitization, e-commerce strategies and network design, and socially responsible operations. She has published numerous articles in leading academic journals such as Management Science, Operations Research, and Manufacturing and Service Operations Management. She has edited and co-edited two books, Research Handbook on Inventory Management and Supply Chain Structures, Coordination, Information, and Optimization. She has also co-authored the book, The Art of Matching, Joy of Living and Operations Innovations, in Chinese. Janet is an Informs Fellow and a Distinguished Fellow and former President of the Manufacturing and Service Operations Management Society, as well as a Department Editor for Management Science and Service Science. She is also a former Area Editor for Operations Research and IIE Transactions. She's a recipient of the Distinguished Overseas Young Scholar Award by the Natural Science Foundation of China, and was named a Chang Jiang Chair Professor by the Ministry of Education in China. Janet, it's an honor to have you here. You were one of the great names of our field, so thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be invited.
Okay, Janet, so you were born in 1960 in China. From which city do you come from?
Beijing. My name is actually after the city, my Chinese name, Jingsheng. Means I was born in Beijing.
Good. Tell me a bit about your family, starting with your parents.
Oh, my parents, they are intellectuals. They study philosophy, political science, and foreign history. And they were much, when I was born, my father was already 53 and mom was 43. So I was the baby at the home. My father was born 1907 and mother's 1970.
Wow. And what did they do for a living?
They were editors for a publisher in China on social science and political studies.
Mm-hmm. Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have one brother. Two sisters. They are all older than me, more than 10 years.
Uh-huh. You grew up during the Cultural Revolution in China. What are your memories from that period?
Yeah, that was a turmoil time. But I was young, so I guess at first I didn't feel it's just the world that I see. I didn't really have a clear memory what is the normal world, but it just turns out to be like that way. So it's instead of, like my sisters and brother, and they would see an upside down world, yeah, the same as adults. But at my age, didn't really realize that.
Uh-huh.
I was at a kindergarten. And it's a boarding school. And I started that when I was before I turned 1 year old. So that was a system in China where my parents were intellectuals to do their editing work. So they were eligible to put their kids to boarding school. So I was there for all these young years. And so I only came home to see, to be with the family on the weekend. At that time, there were 6 working days per week. So Saturday evening and the Sunday was the family time, it's the weekend. And on Mondays, I go back to school. And then the same for my sister and brothers. And then they were in their high schools and they were also in boarding school. Then the year when I was turning 6 was the starting of a Cultural Revolution, where the intellectuals was considered to be dangerous because they have ideas and they may have some thoughts that is not, so that's can be considered counter-revolutionary. And my parents were among the victims of being attacked.
Uh-huh. And to what extent was your family affected by this socio-political movement?
Because first of all, my father was quite senior, given his age. He was among the earliest to study Marxism, to introduce Marxism into China. It's in the, you know, China was the imperial system for a long time, up to the early 20th century. And my father was born at that time. And then when he entered college, it was a time where the people, especially the youth, were searching ideas to save China, to move to a democratic China. So my father immersed himself to study Marxism and study many philosophical thoughts. And he was, before college, he was educated through Confucius. And in college, he was exposed to Western thoughts. And in his generation, people find Marxism was really ideal, the communist idea that. So he was very into it. So at that time, he was also contributing to some writing in a nationalist party publication. But at that time, it was both the nationalism and the communist parties are joined. So you can imagine all the intellectual young people who are active in that, so didn't see any difference, okay? But later, my father after the communists took over in 1949, my father was recruited to Beijing. He was working in a publisher in Shanghai, and then he was recruited as a expert to the publisher in Beijing, and he was working in the philosophy department. And so at one time, I think a top official in the party wanted to influence the collection of works that he was editing in a volume of philosophical work. And then he didn't follow the exact order of the top official because he wanted to follow his, his professional judgment. But that offended that leader. So when the Cultural Revolution started, he was appointed particularly to be criticized. So he was one of the early targets of the revolution in his institution. Then my mother also was affected because she studied English, and then she, in her editing work, she studies, she edits work on foreign history. And then that was, they accused that have the, you know, possibility, suspicion of some counter-revolutionary ideas, and because of the Western, yeah, Western source connections.
Uh-huh.
So they were both affected.
Uh-huh. And did they get arrested?
Sort of. They were not allowed to come to home. They had to stay in a special lodging housing in the institution, in the building of the publisher. And then every other day, they were asked to confess their thoughts and actions that was not revolutionary, not loyal to the Communist Party, to their colleagues or mass, and they were so they were not allowed to go home, and occasionally we would see them to come to where we lived, but they were as janitors to clean the public restroom and to make and sweep yards or things like that. And then they were also called upon to be criticized in front of the mass.
Wow, that's awful. And yeah. Until when this kept on going?
I think there were acute years in 1966 through 1968. At that time, they were sent to countryside. And what's what it is called the seventh cadre school that so arrange the people who work in the city, officials or intellectuals, going there to do intense labor work. So there are only two kinds of things. So one is the labor work, another is studying Marxism. So they were sent there. At the first, my parents, they couldn't stay together as a couple. Each would live with either male colleagues or female colleagues. They were housed in villagers' houses. And then at the same time, they learn farming, and then they also learn how to make limestone and bricks, and then building their own houses. So they belong to Ministry of Culture, which has many institutions belong to that ministry. Many of their colleagues in other institutions, like a theater, museums, or other publishers, went there. So it's they all learn farming and do the same thing.
Wow. Until which year they were subjected to these activities in this labor camp?
Okay, so... So they were phases. They were at first, as I said, they started to build their house. Even when they have built house, my parents were still considered to be at a degree that has to be criticized on a daily basis or a weekly basis. And after maybe another a couple of years, in 1970, it started to be a little better, so they stopped have those frequent criticism, and then they were allowed to live together, my parents, so they stopped with that, but they were sent to another part of the county where my father went to coal mine work. And my mother was doing kitchen work and washing vegetables and things in the river. And I remember those. So at that time they were sent to there. And then after maybe a year or two. Then the situation got a little better. Then they recognized their aging. So they were sent to yet another place to do work, which is lighter. So planting vegetables and stuff. So it's like that.
Yeah. And when did they return to Beijing?
They returned to Beijing 1973. But during those years, I followed them. So they went to 1968. They were sent to the countryside. As I told you that I was in kindergarten. So after that year, I was supposed to go to elementary school. But the Cultural Revolution started, so all the schools shut down. And there was no school. And I finished my kindergarten and the boarding school. So I supposed to came home. To come home and to go to the elementary school. But then my parents were not allowed to be home, and my sister and the brother all went to revolution, and nobody was home. And the neighbors accommodated me. So I lived with many, many different families. Some of them are friends of my parents, and some of them are, the parents of my friends. So I had a lot of experience living in different families, and then get exposed to different kind of culture, different kind of cuisine. So early life, I had very rich experience, but people are very kind to me, I would say. Even my parents were in trouble. I experienced a lot of kindness, and I also learned to be kind to other people. That's a survival early years. I know if I care about others, people also like me. So I just learned. After they went to the countryside in 1969, I was sent to the cadre school in the countryside, and many kids like my parents, the kids were sent to there, and then they housed us in a high school in the county, and where the school, as I said, there's no school everywhere, so there's no high school, and then that high school is a boarding school, so they just housed all these kids, and called that school communist school. You know, when I was nine, I didn't realize how odd that name is until much older. I was thinking, wow, the school is called a communism school. Okay, so I was there, boarding school again, and all the kids do most labor work, and did a little study, and mostly some mouse work. And then we go to see our parents only one weekend of each month.
Uh-huh. It seems that you came back to Beijing before your parents because you have to look after your sister. Is that right?
Right. I told you before. Before my parents came back, I think late 1973, but I was in 1972, in spring 1972. One of my sisters who went to Inner Mongolia to work as a shepherd and got sick and had to be treated in Beijing. And my parents were not allowed. So I was the only one who were permitted to take care of my sister. So I went to there, and then our house apartment was already taken. So we were allocated to a very tiny room, which before it's like for the gatekeeper to stay. So it's like 8 square meter, a little room. And we stayed there for more than a year before my parents came back. And then after that, we were given a 1-bedroom apartment So four of us live there.
Okay. I mean, it should have been a very tough period. And by the time you went to Beijing to look after your sister, you were only 12. So a lot of responsibility at that very young age, a lot of moving. How many times did you change schools?
Changed four times. Yeah, once from Beijing to the communism, and then moved to a local school in the countryside, and then I moved back to Beijing. And then after my parents came, we moved to another part of town, so another school.
And how did you manage to enjoy yourself or even to have some fun during those turbulent years?
Well, kids are kids. So when the Cultural Revolution started, so there was no school and all grades had no school. And we live in a compound where, so they housed all the people who work for in the same institute in similar neighborhoods. And then we just follow the older kids to go to play all kinds of games, like jumping ropes and swimming and ping pong and paper cutting and knitting, all kinds of things. Okay, so it just besides studying, we play many, many games. And then cooking. And it's, so just experiments a lot of things. So it's still fun. Yeah, there are some scary things, a lot of scary things. You see people committed suicide. You see people being criticized. And then, but I think when I was that young, there were still fun times.
It seems that you learned how to bike in that very famous square in Beijing, correct?
Yeah, Tiananmen Square. So that's after I came back to Beijing, taking care of my sister. And then I learned a lot of the kids of my age already learned how to ride bicycle. In the countryside, no, there was no bicycle. And then I really wanted to learn bicycle. So at the time, China, Beijing was not as crowded. And we live close to Tiananmen Square. So my friends just taught me bicycling on Tiananmen Square.
Uh-huh. And what happened in your life when the Cultural Revolution ended in 1976?
Yeah, so at that time, later years in the Cultural Revolution, we didn't have a regular curriculum. It's still after Mao's thought that everyone needs to learn practical stuff. So even for school age, middle school, you need to learn from farmers, need to learn from workers and from soldiers. So each year we would devote a lot of times to go to these, like 1 month in a factory, 1 month in a farm, and 1 month in, military training. So, and then the rest of the time, mostly it's like a criticize, the old thoughts and stuff. So there's not a regular curriculum. And, but I did gain a lot of experience, assembly worker or, doing or kitchen work and stuff. And then after the Cultural Revolution, the curriculum, the regular classes, the regular curriculum started to kick in. And we were exposed to the real studying. So that was fun. I had a great time.
Uh-huh. And why did you decide to study math in college?
So, at that time, it was 1977. So 1976 was the end of the Cultural Revolution. So after a year, that the fall of 1976 was the ending. So after a year, proposed by Deng Xiaoping, the leader there at time, the college education restarted. And then regularly, also the TV also started to to start to broadcast some lectures. So in the early 1978, so 77, the end of 77, I think it was the first exam for students who wanted to enter college. And then starting maybe January, February of 78, I listened to a professor who taught over TV geometry, the plane geometry, and defining point and line and plane. I just thought it was so elegant, and I was never exposed to that. I was just thinking, yeah, I was just completely attracted to it. And then I thought I wanted to study mathematics. And then also I was pretty good at mathematics. All the subjects were taught. It feels like me, like the student who now play video game. It's just, we have a homework. I couldn't wait to solve them. And similarly as the physics. So I like both the physics and the mathematics. And I was also very lucky. I wasn't in a graduating class to enter college. So the first batch of students who went to college is the early 1978. So only after a few months, then there will be an entrance exam for the regular 78. But I was still in high school, not in a graduating class, but our school allocated three positions to go to a screening test. Say, if they pass, they can enter the entrance exam. So I was selected, and the three of us all passed the screening, and then we were only given 10 days to start entrance exam, and then we have to decide what major to do. So what I selected is the math and the physics. So every school I apply is there's a two choices. So I name math number one and physics number two. So and then I could only choose schools in Beijing because my parents didn't want me to go outside Beijing because all my sisters and brother and are not in Beijing. So, anyway, luckily I also got in. So I went to Beijing Normal University's math department. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And did you enjoy your college years?
Yes, yeah. It's very special, as I said. The cultural revolution for 10 years, there was no regular college. And so there was a huge accumulation of, it's very, very competitive to get into college because all these people who didn't have the chance now wanted to do. So it's very, very selective. And also the normal university is supposed to train teachers for college and high schools. And then because of the country needs a lot of teachers, they made a restriction, say, if you are already teachers, if you go to college, you can only go to normal universities. And Beijing Normal University is number one, is the topest in China, the oldest and the most prestigious normal school. So they get the top students from all over the country, from each province. And so very selective. So my class was really, really good. They were teachers, many, many of them were teachers. And then also another restriction is like married students couldn't go to, you know, the general university. They had to go to normal school. So it's just lots of talents. And then because they were already in their 20s and 30s, and they were, they were not allowed to study at a normal age. So when they started, they really, really appreciated the opportunity. And they were so thirsty about everything. And they would read lots of books beyond what, the curriculum offer. So that atmosphere really had some impact on me. And I see there are things not you want to explore beyond, you know, what the class taught. And then also it just, they have so many talents because partly because there's no other things to do beyond the mathematic learning and teaching. They were musicians, you know, singers or instruments or other artistic and poetic. So yeah, it was wonderful.
Well, it should have been inspired for you, right? Because you had these people that were really, as you said, very interested in learning because they didn't have the chance before. And by seeing them, you know, taking the opportunity and valuing the opportunity made you also motivated to work hard and do a good job. But did you have the chance to study art during those years?
No. We were, yeah, purely mathematics and the physics. You know, at the time, I think it's a traditional view physics, the applied field for mathematics. So we learned a lot of physics. So yeah, so that's where we see applications. Maybe if it's astronomy or things like this, but never thought about applying to something else. But then in my last year of school, I learned some students already prepared to apply for grad school. As the, you know, our system just started to be normal, before my last year, I didn't even know we could apply for graduate school, but there were some pioneer students, they knew. So they were preparing. And then I started to think, oh yeah, I want to go to graduate school. And so I started to look for where I could apply. There are not many places. And the Chinese Academy of Science is among the very few that offers master programs. And I was thinking at that time, I started to study probability. And the professor was also pretty motivating. And I just felt the future is a probability because the world is uncertain. And I was determined that I want to study, you know, when I go to graduate study, I want to further my knowledge about the probability. And it would be nice to see applications about that. So in Chinese Academy of Science, I find that they were like operations research, we're under operations research. That's where I learned this name. And under operations research, there is the Catholic branch. And they offer queuing theory and Markov decision processes. And among these two, I find the Markov decision processes particularly fascinating because it's about controlling a stochastic system. You could take actions to control, to influence the trajectory of the stochastic system. I just find it's fancier than queuing theory. Queuing theory is like a descriptive and a performance prediction. And now I can control. So I applied for that major.
Right. You went to a different place to do your master's, right? And
I went to the Chinese Academy of Science.
Yeah. And there were like different branches.
So Chinese Academy of Sciences has lots of the. You would have the physics branch. You would have a math branch. You would have a chemistry branch or biology branch. You would have many, many, many different institutions. In the math branch, there are four institutions: the pure math, and applied math. And system engineering, and computation. And I went to the Institution of Applied Mathematics.
Right. How long did you take to complete your master's, and what was your dissertation about?
Okay, so we would have all the students in the in Chinese Academy would go to a graduate school for 1 year of foundational courses. And then they all go to their institutions to follow their advisors to do research. And that varies from 1.5 years to 2 years. For me, I finished in 1.5 years. And most of it, I think, so then after that, so I went there. So I finished at the end of the December of 1984. Yeah, so that's 2.5 years. I studied a theory about the Markov decision processes because there's some basic theory about that. And then it says the transition matrix, the transition rates are finite. And then my professor says, what if it's infinite? You have an infinite state and an infinite, no bound, the transition rates has no bound. So I was given that very, basic theory about it. So I managed to prove things, to find conditions to extend theory. Yeah.
So it was a theoretical work?
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah. And did you publish that work in a journal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually was a single authored paper and published in the very top math journal. And I won an award for that from my institute. So yeah, after I graduated, I stayed in the same institution, become a research staff. And then, during my first year, they gave me an award for that work.
Uh-huh.
And then that actually was somewhat a precede of my studying abroad. You know, my professor introduced my work to a Dutch scholar. The Dutch scholar was pleased to see my result. And then and told my advisor, say, she should go to study abroad.
That's nice. Did you code during your master's?
Yeah, we have to. We were required to do some Fortran programming. Yeah, there's a computer language class we have to study. But in my research, I didn't do it. But I did take that course and did the programming and
right.
Passed.
So you were exposed to computers and all of that?
Yeah. Although my research didn't require that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a basic pencil and a paper.
Mm-hmm. And what came after the master's? You mentioned that you stayed at an institute, but give me some more details about it.
So when I was a student in the master program, it was interesting. At that time, there are not many people female students studying math. In my year, in the Institute of Math, we have 19 students. These students are all coming from different math programs of universities. And then 19 of them, I was the only girl. And I met my future husband there. So we dated throughout those time. At the time, we were both in dorm, so we can see each other every day, and we study together, we do fun things together. But then after graduation, my situation changed. He was not from Beijing, and he were allocated a room or a bed, shared a room with other young research staff near the institution. And then because my parents were in Beijing, so they would not give me a place. So I had to go to live with my parents, which is another corner of Beijing, requiring 1 hour's bicycling. So that was very, very difficult to separate us. At that time, because he would not be allowed to live with me because if we were not married, only married you can live together. So then we just bravely decided that we want to get married for that reason. So he could stay with me, with my parents. And then otherwise he would come to with me, and then he would, you know, at night he would ride bicycle and or so it's a bad arrangement. So we just decided to do that. And our parents approved, even though we didn't make any penny. But then a professor in our institute learned about our situation, and then he happened to have a spare room waiting to be exchanged to something. So he lent it to us. So that's not too far from our institution. So we were lucky. And then we just lived there.
Yeah, it seems that every step for you in your life was...
something lucky.
Yeah. So there's this two sides of the coin, right? That every time you go further, there is some obstacle, but at the same time, you kind of have a bit of a luck, and it.
I guess I was. I am very adventurous. So some people, you know, you would say, "Oh, I wanted to see how this boyfriend." You know, you want to test this boyfriend, and then whether he could buy you a ring or something to prove something. And it didn't matter to me. I was just thinking, yeah, I wanted to be together with him. And then we didn't make money. I didn't need him to buy anything. And then we just get married.
Great. Right. Yeah. And talking about being adventurous, what motivated you to pursue a PhD in the U.S. and how was the process?
Since we were, after we got married, and then we both worked at the same institute, we do some research. And he was also, because he was in optimization field, and then his professors got a lot of national projects, like a Three Gorge Dam project. So he was very busy. He was, you know, some sort of a practical project, and then there's very important, government decisions. So he was very busy. My professor is very theoretical, and then he thinks as a young researcher, I should do as much research as possible. So I was pretty much alone to do research. But then I was, because of theoretical, my professor mostly say, oh, whether you can extend this to extend, relax this and extend it, very mathematical motivation. And I felt a little bored. So I was, of course, I was working, but I would not say I was really like a full speed or motivated. And I was more motivated to be a good wife, you know, decorating and cooking, decorating the house, cooking and waiting for my husband to be back. So sort of like that. But then after some time, in the fall of 1985, we started work. And then towards the fall of 1985, we started to learn some fellow students went to the U.S., went to the U.S. for PhD programs. And then before that, we thought everyone who studied abroad would have a financial support from families. You know, you would have a relatives in overseas. So we didn't think anything. We didn't think possible to study abroad. But then they told us, the PhD programs can offer fellowships for students. So if we translate, if we apply, so it's possible, but applying for, at that time, there's no foreign exchange, and we have to exchange U.S. dollars in a black market. And then taking a TOEFL test would take a 1 month salary, and taking GRE would take a 3 months salary. That was prohibitive because given us just started to work. And then they told us a trick. They said, since our master thesis in the academy is kind of a dissertation because it's original math, original research, and it's a proven, it's a proof for us a capability of doing original research. So they suggest a way translate our thesis and then send it to the key references and then asking to be studying, be a PhD student for those professors. So I just followed suit. And then also we started to learn English and then TOEFL and then translating. I learned how to type, both a typewriter and then and type. And then, so then eventually we all got in and then my husband got into Columbia University with a fellowship. And then I got into UNC Chapel Hill and Georgia Tech SYE. But both professors are on sabbatical. And even UNC professor says, why don't you come next year? And then Georgia Tech professor says, you can come in the first year, you just study. But after I come back, you can do research. In the first year, we don't have a financial aid for foreign students, but second year you can do TA or RA. So at that time, you know, there's no internet, no email. Every communication, you know, take months. So I just thought I would not be able to come that year to the US. So so I wrote to a thank you letter to that professor. I said, thank you, but without money, I cannot come. And then after a month, so it's almost like the start of the summer, I received a letter and he was very kind. This is Professor Richard Sofoso at Georgia Tech. And he says, in this situation, I will hire you as a RA using my own grant, not the school money. And you can do some research and then to support your first year. So then I can come. So it was very happy.
Yeah. Again, right? A lot of obstacles, but in the end you had this.
Yeah. I always have some luck, I think. Yeah. I was already prepared not to come.
Yeah. And so suddenly you were in this new country. And how was it?
Well, it was shocking, of course. It's the first time to fly, an international flight, and then first time to see highway, first time to take a taxi, first time to see the automatic store, the doors open. It's just like like a sci-fi. So it and vending machines stuff and it was very eye-opening. Supermarket, you didn't have to carry your own bag, and then you didn't have to have some attendants. You're just self-selecting. So it's eye-opening. And then my English was very poor and struggling, so didn't understand mostly what professor says, but luckily for mathematics classes, you can just read the equations. So that was, that way we survived. Oh, another story was, we were, one went to Atlanta, one went to Columbia, went to New York. So at a time before we were leaving, and then a Dutch scholar visited the Chinese Academy. So my husband and I accompanied him to see some parks in Beijing. And he learned that we were going to this path. And he said, how possible for your young couple to be separate? We said, no choice. And then he mentioned, he said, hey, there's a professor at Columbia and the business school is Avi Fedgren. And then I said, oh, I know Avi Fedgren's name. I read his papers, but I didn't know You know, there was a PhD programs in business school in China. There's just not, at that time, no, there was no, you couldn't imagine a PhD program in a business school. And then, yeah, through him, and then, and he and Avi were fellow students. And then their professor was the professor who actually recognized my work, praised my work. So for my master's thesis, and then he was very happy to recommend me to Avi. And then, after my husband arrived at Columbia, got the application package from Avi and sent mail to me, and I applied. And then Columbia Business School admitted me. I was the second Chinese student they've ever admitted.
Wow.
So...
yeah,
very... so that's an early generation. So that actually another adventure, right? So this is another adventure is going to a business school. I never thought you have heard my background, math, and then later OR into sort of engineering, but never thought about the management, you know. So that was another challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And what did you study in your PhD?
I studied inventory theory. At first, I was going to study with Avi. I was thinking studying with Avi, but Avi was on sabbatical after I passed my qualifying after my first term there. So the director of the PhD program at that time, and also my later advisor, Paul Zipkin, and came to tell me to say, you should start to do research. It was a motivation to earn some money. I studied to, I heard that he had a vacant of RA ship. At that time, we in the Columbia Business School, we were had a fellowship. But if you, a part of the fellowship include you have to be TA. But then if you can do research assistantship, you get additional money. At that time, it's $700 per semester. And then that summer, a student who used to be RA were transitioned to another program. And he told me I could do RA. I could apply for that RA position to get more money. So I would talk to Paul. I said, oh, I heard you have a position. I want to apply. But I'm not very fluent in programming. I didn't have much experience in programming. I thought RA would mean programming. So I said I didn't have much experience, but I can learn. Most of my experience were in mathematical proofs, but he said, that's fantastic. And then read these papers. So he didn't ask me to program. He asked me to read papers and to continue to prove. So that was, yeah. So I was saying, yeah, somehow I was lucky. So then I started to work with him, and then I get the results. So, and then later, that's part of my dissertation.
Right. So, again, a lot of theoretical work, but there was also some computational work.
Yeah, there. Later I had to do computation. So at the first I thought that was done, but then the professor said, no, you're not done. After you prove the optimal policy, you need to compute. You need to say what's the algorithm to compute. And then I found the algorithm, and then I thought, oh, maybe we can write a paper. And then the professor says, no, you have to compute. So then I need to learn program and then compute. After computer program, then you have to tell the story, what's the insights. So yeah, that way I learned operations and management research.
Nice. Your first son was born during your PhD, right?
Yeah. And actually he was born... exactly the day of the second anniversary after I landed to the U.S.
Okay.
In September.
And was it hard for you to find a position after concluding your PhD?
Yeah, it was very difficult. The market was very slow. Even a couple of years before us, at that time, the economy was bad. There were not many openings, and then there were also cumulative students who wanted to look for this. And plus, there were a lot of new Chinese students. So like our generation, we didn't think of staying in the US. We were thinking of going back to China after studying. But then during our time, there is a Tiananmen Square incidents, the student move democratic movement in June of 1989.
I was a kid, so, but I remember that incident. Very famous, you know, the person coming in front of a tank in the square.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that changed, you know, yeah, at that time, people, including the parents and the colleagues, think it's not a good idea to go back to China in that climate. And encourage us to look for ways to stay in the States after graduation. So then we started to look for thinking about you know, going to being professors. So yeah, so not only the regular crowd of students from the program, now there are a lot of Chinese students also wanted to find a job. So yeah, it's a very crowded market, with many more applicants than the, you know, positions available. And then for us, it's also, we grew up in a planned economy. So all the jobs are like assigned. You know, you didn't have to go through an interview. You didn't know the existence of cover letters, curriculum vita, and then interviewing presentation. Didn't have a concept of all that. So it was very, you know, awkward. So we have to learn these things. And then even choose some English name. The market was slow for a couple of years. And then, so the early graduates says, oh, if they look at a Chinese name, they don't even know how to pronounce, they don't take a second look. So we heard that. And then we each, my husband and I, each gave a choose an English name. So also because we were the early comers, so many people don't remember the Chinese names, and then they have difficulty remembering my name. So that was another motivation. I wanted to have an English name. So because the nurses usually call me Jean, and then so I thought, oh, maybe I would just call Jean. So I wrote on my CV, J-E-A-N. And my professor looked at my CV, says Jean Song. Maybe that's too short. How about Jeanette Song? I said, okay. So that's how I got my name. And then it turns out also, you know, interacting with the parents in daycare of things, and people, it's easier for people to remember Jeanette than Jin Shen. So then I mostly go by Jeanette.
Right. And you finally joined UC Irvine in 1991, right?
Mm-hmm. 1991.
Yeah. After 2 to 3 years there, I think you spent a period in UC Berkeley in 1994 when your daughter was born, right?
Yeah. My daughter was born towards the spring of my third year. And my husband was not able to find a job near UC Irvine, so he ended a job at the city of Berkeley. He worked in a firm that was founded by a Berkeley professor, so that applies, you know, quantitative methods for investment. So we started our commuting marriage. And it was not easy for us to find the same, you know, position at the same place while we have So after my daughter was born, after that's my exactly, I finished in 3 years. So I was qualified to have one quarter of sabbatical in the UC system. And then I also can have one quarter of, maternity, some benefits and child rearing some leave. And plus summer. So I moved to UC Berkeley as a visiting scholar to be with my husband. So the family lived together. So during that time, uh-huh. And then later I commuted one quarter to teach.
Uh-huh. At that time, you were working on assemble to order systems. Could you highlight some of your contributions associated with that topic?
Yeah. So the topic was started with my consulting during my third year or even second year as assistant professor. So a company who have multiple products and then the customers are satisfied if all the products are delivered at the same time. So they call the order complete rate. But when I, during my study of inventory theory, I only studied a single item inventory system. You don't consider some other products. But then I felt the problem was very practical. Is that everyone who, if we go to stores, we buy more than one item. And then the inventory management for any multi-item system should consider demand correlation among the items. So I talked to, at the conferences, I talked to industry, people from IBM or AT&T, and they told me they were trying to look for solutions because that's the time when these computer systems or telephone systems were not made to stock, but made is assembled to order because the technology advances. So the component even component cost can change, and component technology can change. If you assemble to products, you cannot sell it. Then the components, being assembled is devaluated. And even it's not the same generation anymore. So then they call this assemble to order system, and then they. Or you realize that this is very difficult computationally because you have a high dimensional computation and stochastics. You have to deal with the joint distributions and stuff. So I was very motivated to study that. I couldn't find literature about that. So what I do is, I think it's influenced by my mathematical training. I wanted to have a model that could lead to an exact analysis. A lot of people to realize it's very difficult. So their first reaction was to approximate system. But I was not satisfied that. I wanted to first understand the structure, mathematical structure, so I could get more insights about how do you simplify and approximate. So I built several exact the mathematic model and conduct the exact analysis. I think that's part of my contribution. So the modeling and the exact analysis, building on that, I have developed more efficient ways to approximate and then to optimize.
Very interesting. You went back to Colombia in 1996. But you did not stay there for very long, correct?
Yeah. So when I was in Irvine, and after the year of Berkeley, I went back to Irvine. And then during that year, that was my fifth year of being assistant professorship. And then Columbia reached to me to think they have some demand for supply chain faculty, and they think I may be a good fit. So they asked my interest. And of course, Columbia is wonderful. I graduated from there, and then it's a very, very stimulating environment. I like New York City. And on top of that, my husband was in the financial industry. So we thought, oh, maybe, this also can bring us together, you know, as a family. So I applied, and then I got the job, and then I went and I moved 2 kids. But Irvine also liked me, and then the dean was very happy. He said, you didn't have to resign, and if you, something, you know, didn't work out, you can come back. And then during the year I went there, and then they also say, hey, we think your record is pretty good, and then we want to process your tenure. And then, so it's in that my first year, I went there, I went to New York in the fall of 1996. So then the following semester, the spring of 1997, they say, hey, you have tenure. And then, however, nobody can be on leave for more than 2 years. So at the end of the spring of 1998, May 1st of 1998, I have to decide whether I want to take that tenured offer or staying at Columbia. Of course, Columbia encouraged me to stay, and it's a very, very difficult decision. But yeah, there is still uncertainties about the tenure at Columbia because I'm not there yet. So at the moment, so I was just thinking, if I don't get tenure at Columbia, I had to find another place to go. And then no place will be better than Irvine. You know, Irvine is a beautiful place to live and work, and it's research oriented. It was just the program is much smaller than Columbia, but it's still very good. And then thought, okay. And then also it's easier to raise a family. And so I just decided, I think either way it will work out. But but anyway, I moved back to Irvine. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of back and forth between West and mm-hmm. East Coast. So.
A lot of each summer was moving.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, my family crossed country twice with the 2 kids. So we saw a lot of the country.
Wow. So you went driving instead of flying.
You were driving.
Yeah.
Some moves were flying, but some moves were driving.
Well, excellent.
When the kids were older.
Yeah. After returning to UC Irvine, you did some work on the approximation of the inventory network through single location models. Could you elaborate more on this?
At UC Irvine, I taught a course called Supply Chain Management. At that time, the topic was still emerging. And I played a beer game in that elective. And some students realized the Buvet effect, realized that they didn't know much about supply chain and the good ways of managing inventory. And then they were curious about, what's the good solution? How do I use it in my practice? And then we have theory. We have theory. And then there's a celebrated results of Clark and Scoff. It's even though it's much streamlined over the years, but it's still not at a level you can teach MBA students. They were just taught about the news vendor solution, which is a single stage, single item, single period. And now we talk about dynamic, multiple stage, dynamic environment, multiple period, multiple stage. So I was just thinking, what if we approximate the multi-stage system by single stage system and then treat it as a news vendor at the level of news vendor complexity and how bad it is or how good it is. I was just curious. So I explored this question with my PhD student. It turns out to be very successful. So I was very, very happy. I think that's a major advancement. And then from then on, we were encouraged, you know, we developed a series of other approximations, single stage for other systems, single stage approximation for other systems.
Uh-huh.
And then...
Very nice.
Yeah.
So in 2003, you moved again, this time to North Carolina to work mm-hmm. at the prestigious Duke University. How did that happen? A lot of moving.
A lot of moving, right. So I think Duke at that time was trying to build a OM group. And they were looking for someone more senior to help build that group. And then they contacted many people, and including me, and then to see whether my interest. So yeah, this Duke, of course, it's prestigious and interesting to me. And then another thing is my husband. It's maybe an opportunity for my husband also to work. We're in the same location. So I applied and I got a job and I decided to move. So I moved again. And then, so that's...
But for the last time.
Another move.
I mean, so far.
and then I got sick of moving.
Yeah.
No more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you then worked on a variety of interesting topics, including supply chain coordination mechanisms, resilient supply chain models, and sustainability. Could you please describe these applications and mention some of your main findings after conducting extensive research on these topics?
Okay. So this is, again, it's related to teaching, actually. So it's like my news vendor approximation of the serial system when I was teaching supply chain, playing beer game. And my first job teaching assignment at Duke was teaching in the core course of operations management in a global executive MBA program. And this program, you know, the participants are from all over the world. They have their work experience. And there are some residential programs in different continents, and then followed by online learning. And then because this is a global EMBA, they named the course as a global operations management. Although the real content is pretty much just like the regular operations management course. But I was exposed, so I was curious. I was thinking, what is global? You know, what is there for global operations? What's special for global operations? So starting then, I started to think about this. I explored it. But then another thing is, because we were developing our group, and we wanted to have more electives, and being a senior, I bravely take the initiative to teach a course that was there but not taught for many years. It's called the International Operations, the elective. And I never studied that subject. So I had to study what is international operations, operating plants in different countries. And then you have a tax, you have exchange rates, all of that. And then at the same time, there's, the whole world is like the outsourcing time, globalization. And that was the, I don't know whether you were aware of that, 2005, there is a very popular book by Thomas Friedman. It's called The World is Flat. So, yeah, there was a lot of outsourcing to China and then many, many global participants in the supply chain. So through this teaching, I got exposed to think about the sourcing and supplier selection, supplier management, supplier development, and then coordination of global sites. It just broadened. Before, when I was studying inventory theory, it's something sourcing is, your supplier is already there. It's already selected. Then you just manage the information and the material flow in the most efficient way. And now, even you operate in a global world, you have to say which supplier you work with, and whether you have qualified suppliers, whether the supplier has the quality, and then what about the risk, and whether this is sustainable, whether they use child labor, whether they use unethical material, and all these responsibilities, sustainability, and the global risk came into play. So, yeah, and I taught many cases and I studied, but I feel our theory was not mature and that there's a lot to study. And so I started to explore these. So in addition to the traditional methodology I used, like stochastic modeling and optimization, and now many of these models involve game theory, mechanism design, and many other, social aspects. So I enjoyed it a lot. I learned a lot. And then developing various dual sourcing, sustainability, resilience strategies.
Yeah, fascinating. And what are promising avenues of research when it comes to these topics?
There's still a lot, because the supply chain is very long and very complex. And then the network structure can vary a lot, and then any link can be disrupted. So we still need a lot of research to have more efficient and robust design and implementable strategies and incentives, because once your supply chain spread, it's inevitable, it's decentralized. So how do you coordinate the information and incentives for people to work together? And then there are a lot of regulations and geopolitical risks as well. So there are a lot. And then now with AI, with learning, earlier I also get into supply chain digitization. How do you use advanced information and computation technology to digitize supply chain to be efficient?
Yeah, these are all very exciting topics. I think one example is the one involving Starbucks that you studied, right?
Yeah. So I taught a case about Starbucks' practice of managing the coffee supply chain. So the coffee farmers, and then the processors, then the importers, and then the retailers. Starbucks is the retailing. And at the time, Starbucks was a globalization, and they have exponential growth, right? They set up stores not only in the U.S., but globally. And then, of course, they need sustained high-quality, premium quality of coffee. However, the coffee mostly grow in the less developed economy due to the climate, the altitude required. And these people, in a poor country and often didn't have enough resources. So if you don't help them, they may not plant sustainably. And then also because the supply chain is decentralized in each stage, you may not have a fair trade. So the farmers got poorly treated, poorly paid. So that endangers the supply chain's sustainability and ultimately everyone on this chain. So they develop a program to layers. So each layers have to follow certain guidelines for fair pay and for sustainable practice. And I felt that was very nice. So these are practices, but I wanted to have an analytical model, to pinpoint the key factors and the key challenges and the solutions. So I developed a model for dynamic mechanism design to implement such programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you think about supply chain in a global scale, there are, you know, a large amount of challenges, issues, and things to study, to optimize, and still remains a really rich field of research, and there's a lot of things to be done. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So each time we do modeling, due to tractability, we have to make some assumptions.
Yeah.
So once this works, then you think about the what else. Yeah. So whether you can advance this further.
Mm-hmm. So let's change topics a little bit now. Jeanette, tell me about your involvement with Informs.
I involved whenever I can. So I involved in various award committees and chaired a number of committees. I don't remember all of them, but I did. Each time I was asked, I did. I wanted to, you know, help recognize the excellence and help to cultivate this, you know, respect to good work. So I do participate that. And then I also was active in editorial boards, being associated editors and department editors in a number of journals, trying to, you know, to maintain the quality and also cultivating the good ideas. And I was also the president of our OM community, the Manufacturing and the Service Operations Management.
Mm-hmm. You always kept your connection with China alive over the years, right?
Yeah, because I was among the early generations to come to the States and then later stayed as academics. So there are a lot of young students and young faculty. They really wanted to get exposed to, you know, the frontier topics and the research. So I was invited a lot to give lectures and give summer schools over there. And at the same time, I could take the chance to see my family. So and I thought that was very worthwhile, because these young people, they have the energy, and then if given the good direction, they go, you know, they put their energy to the right place. So I think it's you know, it's very worthwhile to be able to provide some guidance.
Yeah, so that's a very inspiring attitude of yours, trying to go there, give back, and also to nurture some talents and you know, encourage the youngsters around there. That's very nice. What are your views regarding the gender imbalance in our field?
Our field, traditionally was very male-dominated, including the year I entered. Both in China and in the U.S., as I said, in the mathematical field, even in China, was the females were very minority. And then in the U.S. in the early years, too, as a faculty, there are only a few that we, all our role models. And nowadays, if you go to Informs, there are so many. So over the years, I was pleased to see, you know, our PhD program have almost a half and a half, or even maybe more female students. And then each program is now starting to have more and more female faculty. So I was very pleased. And then I just visited in the past month, three top universities to give seminars. One is Columbia Business School, another is NYU's Stern School. And then just last week, I visited MIT, OR Center, and the Sloan School. I was really, really pleased to see the increased number of female faculty. And I also see increasing the number of female PhD students. So I am confident and definitely hope this trend will continue.
Uh-huh. Yes. What are your plans for the future?
My plans in the near future is the same. I'm not bored with my research and teaching, and I'm still I'm still learning new things, and many things I want to answer, and I want to work with the young people, encourage them, and cultivating them. So as I mentioned, there are many things: resilient supply chain, sustainable supply chain, digitization, AI, and at the same time, and I am very, I'm still, I think my mind is still young. Age-wise, I'm old, but I think I'm still, mentality-wise, I'm still like a graduate student. I have appetite to continue to learn many things. So in my spare time, and I keep learning history, reading history, literature, arts, and also even more serious stuff, you know, physics, philosophy, and social sciences. So I'm not bored.
Wow.
I'll continue. Maybe, yeah, someday I, even if I retire, I think my reading and thinking will not stop.
Yeah, so following your parents' steps on being highly intellectual and also very broad in terms of interest. So that's very nice. It keeps yourself active and also, you know, motivated to keep on going on.
Thank you.
Janet, you have made it very far despite the countless challenges you had to face in your personal and professional life. Do you want to leave a final message for the young talents who are going through some difficulties?
Mm-hmm. I think life is full of challenges, but also full of opportunities. I think keep optimistic is very important, and just follow your own interests and be yourself and then be persistent. If you like this stuff, and even people say, that may be risky or something, I think I have this courage. I think it will be good. If you're interested, explore it. And then, as I said, when I was at when I was studying the sample to order system, people say why there's no literature is because it's hard. I was assistant professor, and it was a risky path to take. There will be some safer path I could do, but I was just curious about it, you know. So I just did. So I think then it's what rewarding. So I just feel my philosophy is just follow your own interest and be persistent.
Yeah, that's a great...
And optimistic.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. So, Janet, it was fantastic to have this conversation with you. I learned a lot from you. You're a very inspiring person. And I'm very confident that the viewers and listeners will be also very, very much inspired by your fantastic trajectory, I mean, both personally and professionally. So thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Anand, for the opportunity and for your kind words. And you're very inspiring. And your idea of, making this series was brilliant. And I learned a lot watching a few of these series. And when I have more time, I will definitely follow all of them. Thank you for making this.
Thanks a lot for your words and for your encouragement. That certainly keeps me motivated to keep on going. So, Janet, anytime you want to visit Brazil or, you know, come this side, just let me know, okay? So we can...
Thank you. Welcome to visit North Carolina, too.
Yeah. I've been to North Carolina in 1993. So it's like 30 years ago. So I think I should...
It's
time
to
come back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So, Janet, thanks a lot once again. Take care.
Thank you.
Hope to see you soon. Ciao.
Bye. Bye-bye.